Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. China's economic rise and its greater assertiveness in the Indo-Pacific is setting off alarms in Washington. Already rattled by the devastating consequences from COVID-19, the virus that came from Wuhan. As the two countries navigate their evolving and tense relationship, some analysts are looking back at how American policy toward China failed and what it means for the future. VOA's Jayla DeFranceschi speaks with two influential American military strategists for what they expect next. Mary Alice Salinas narrates.
China's economic might has given it greater geopolitical clout, and under leader Xi Jinping, Beijing clearly aims to replace America's might and global influence and redefine the world order. 3 decades ago, the United States helped China join the World Trade Organization with the expectation that increasing China's trade could lead to its democratization.
We thought that as China got more into trade and economics, that the incompatibility of a communist regime with free trade, or relatively free trade, would essentially cause a change in their behavior.
That expectation not only proved futile, but caused an undesirable ripple effect, according to retired General James Jones. He says China's ascent was achieved by stealth, stealing, and by undermining American and Western security.
We know what they're doing in cyberspace in terms of stealing intellectual properties wherever they can. So China presents a soft, and all their words are very, very gentle and well-meaning. But we shouldn't be deceived. They're planting as many Trojan horses in our countries as they possibly can.
China's goal is to undermine American long-term security alliances as well, says former NATO Supreme Commander General Wesley Clark. Right now, China and its president, Xi Jinping, are focused on their own neighborhood, the Pacific, and first of all, on Taiwan.
The issue today in the Pacific that people I hear talking about most is Taiwan, because we had an agreement when the United States gave up its recognition of Taiwan. We had a pledge that there'd be no forceful solution to Taiwan. But Mr. Xi has not agreed to that pledge.
The South China Sea, you may see an accidental engagement. It is something that China is obviously serious about, and we are obviously serious about keeping the frame of navigation and international law at the top of the list.
China insists the U.S. is the aggressor in the South China Sea and that its relations with Taiwan are an internal issue that Washington should play no role in. But with tensions between Washington and China increasing and Taiwan increasingly seen as a flashpoint, Clark says the situation remains unpredictable, just as it was during the Cold War era.
The Soviet Union knew that if they crossed the inter-German border, there would be a battle and NATO would defend. But we never exactly said when we would escalate to nuclear weapons. Today, you're talking about air, land, sea, space, and cyber. This is very dangerous.
For Jayla DeFranceschi, Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. U.S. Senate Republicans kicked off a sprint Monday to confirm Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court. Just 3 weeks before Election Day, Senate Judiciary Committee hearings began amid continuing concerns about the impact coronavirus infections will have on Barrett's final nomination vote. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson tells us more.
Arriving on Capitol Hill, which has been shut down for the past week in an effort to contain the spread of the coronavirus, Barrett took her first moment before the full Senate Judiciary Committee to explain her judicial philosophy.
Courts are not designed to solve every problem or right every wrong in our public life. The policy decisions and value judgments of government must be made by the political branches, elected by and accountable to the people. The public should not expect courts to do so, and courts should not try.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has a narrow margin of error to fill the vacancy left by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg last month and confirm President Donald Trump's nominee before Election Day on November 3rd.
Brilliant woman.
The Democratic vice presidential candidate, who also is a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said the process rejects the will of American voters.
A clear majority of Americans want whomever wins this election to fill this seat.
But even with some Republican members of the committee testing positive for COVID-19 10 days ago, the Senate is moving forward.
There's nothing unconstitutional about this process. This is a vacancy that's occurred through a tragic loss of a great woman, and we're going to fill that vacancy with another great woman.
Democrats say Trump is rushing to seat Barrett for two reasons, coming up in just the next month.
President Trump has made it clear he wants another of his appointees on the Supreme Court before the election because he anticipates court challenges over the vote, especially over mail-in balloting, which he has repeatedly attacked without any substance. President Trump has indicated he'd be perfectly happy to have a close election decided by a 6-3 conservative majority Supreme Court rather than by the votes of the American people.
And just a week after Election Day, the Supreme Court will hear a key case on the Affordable Care Act, the Obama administration's health care law.
The Trump administration is arguing that the act is unconstitutional in an effect to take away the Affordable Care Act and the health insurance it provides to millions of Americans as a means of unconstitutionality. So Justice Barrett will be one of the deciding factors in this major issue.
Democrats plan to focus on Barrett's possible deciding vote on health care.
Health care coverage for millions of Americans is at stake with this nomination.
But they have already faced Republican warnings not to make the faith of the devout Catholic mom of seven an issue.
We've read stories about your Catholic lifestyle, stories about how you raise your children, stories about how you adopted your children, stories about your Catholic doctrinal beliefs, over and over and over questioning whether you have, I guess, the independence to be a judge, a justice on the United States Supreme Court.
Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, who also is Catholic, said Barrett should not face questions about her religion.
No, her faith should not be considered.
The Senate Judiciary Committee is on track to approve the Barrett nomination by October 22nd, setting up the possibility of a full Senate floor vote as early as the week of October 26th, a week before Election Day. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
We're glad to have you with us for VOA Asia Weekend. As the November 3rd elections are approaching here in the United States, many voters in states that allow it are already taking advantage of casting their ballots early, either in person or by mail. In the state of Virginia, residents got a chance to begin voting early about a month ago, and turnout is beating records. Lacia Bakalets has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
A polling station in Northern Virginia, outside Washington, D.C. People start arriving early in the morning, even though the elections are more than a month away. The line only gets longer as the day progresses. Everybody is wearing masks and practicing social distancing. The average wait time is about 45 minutes.
It seems to be at least an hour, more than an hour perhaps.
And you are ready to stay?
Of course. American democracy is on the line.
I didn't expect it, but it's been moving much faster than I thought it would. Yeah, I have to work today, but this is more important right now, so I'm going to do it.
The turnout so far for the November 3rd elections is at a record high. Fairfax County election head Gary Scott says he hasn't seen lines this long in his 24-year career.
The comparison is we had a grand total of 137,000 absentee voters in person and by mail. And this year we've already sent out more absentee ballots than that. As I said, we've sent 170,000 out. So we're looking that probably two-thirds of our voters will have either cast or received a ballot prior to Election Day.
Experts say, on average, about half of U.S. voters will cast their ballots early.
I'm projecting about 150 million people will vote, and about half of those people will vote prior to the Election Day. So we're looking at about 75 million people that could vote before Election Day.
While there is intense interest in the presidential race, the main reason for this wave of early voting, experts say, is the coronavirus pandemic. People are simply afraid of crowds during Election Day.
I'm just kind of worried about what might happen and making sure that, you know, my normal voting place is going to be open and available. And as I said, I'm very passionate about making some change this year, and been very frustrating, obviously, in 2020.
Because of the pandemic, many states have simplified the procedure of early voting and mail-in ballots. This year, anyone can vote by mail.
Well, when I first started, it was very difficult to vote absentee. The number of reasons you could use as an excuse was very restricted. Well, you were a student, you were in the military, you were traveling.
There is no way to change your decision once you have voted, even if you cast the ballot weeks before the Election Day. But that has not deterred thousands of people.
We're living in highly polarized times in the United States, and many people have already made up their mind. I dare say that some people could have cast their vote a year ago for Donald Trump, and they would not be regret that vote today if they had cast it a year ago. So people have made up their minds a long time ago.
There are, of course, plenty of Americans who will make their decision on November 3rd, and they will be the main target audience for projections of results in the presidential race. Yet, neither party will know the results of early voting until Election Day.
Early voting results are not tabulated. No one, even the election officials, will know before Election Day how many of those early votes were cast for Democrats or Republicans. The vote is, you might say, in the machine, but they haven't hit the button that says count these votes yet.
Every state has the right to decide when to start early voting. Most states will open the polls about a week before Election Day, and it is expected that local election officials will still be counting mail-in ballots days after the November 3rd vote. Полеся Бакалец in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend.
This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Welcome to five-star quarantine in Thailand, where tourists can enjoy a private infinity pool and gourmet meals while obeying some of the world's strictest anti-coronavirus measures. The 300 tourists must complete 14 days of compulsory quarantine and take two coronavirus tests, which is administered by the war room of doctors and security guards. Tan Chinook Pramkul is the assistant director of sales at the Senses Resort.
For Phuket Provincial, we have the stronger policy that the guests have to stay in the room for 24/7 and until they complete the quarantine program.
With all the luxury amenities the resort provides for their customers, this also causes the resorts not to earn as much profit. Hotel speaker Supachok Langpet says, "We had to find other sources of income to support our staff and the local economy." Guests can expect to pay upwards of $5,300 or $18,700 for a family of four.
We choose it to be the quarantine hotel because we want to support and help the local people who are suffering badly from COVID-19 and also for the unemployed staff.
For the most part, guests believe it is worth following the sternest COVID restrictions for the luxury services during the pandemic. A growing local trend in Singapore has sparked John Yee to open a very unique store, Just Ants. The shop sells ant farms and specialist equipment. Items include mini handheld vacuums for catching the insects, tiny feeding dishes, and mealworms used as feed. The 41-year-old quit his job in electronics distribution to open the store after receiving some ants as a gift from his brother-in-law.
I feel that in Singapore, there's a really small community, and I wish to have actually a place where people can gather and share insights and, you know, share their ant-keeping journey and, of course, grow this community.
The shop was forced to close for a period due to a coronavirus lockdown earlier in the year, but has reopened since restrictions were eased and business is picking up. Michelle Cirio is a visitor to the shop.
I think the next time I look at ants, I say, hey, not everybody wants to kill them, you know? And I think I would definitely have a second thought, but it still doesn't mean I would love to keep ants.
Just Ants has 30 to 40 species in stock at the store. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman.
There is no current evidence that dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria, such as E. coli and Salmonella, that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit www.who.int or www.cdc.gov.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, Aboriginal groups have spoken of their grief at an Australian parliamentary inquiry into the destruction by a mining company of sacred sites dating back 46,000 years. In May, Rio Tinto, the world's biggest iron ore miner, destroyed two ancient rock shelters at the Juukan Gorge in Western Australia's Pilbara region as part of a new development, despite fierce opposition from indigenous groups. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Indigenous groups say they're in mourning at the desecration of our sacred sites at the Juukan Gorge. It was blown up by Rio Tinto in pursuit of high-grade iron ore, despite protests by community leaders. Aboriginal witnesses have told a parliamentary committee that Aboriginal culture is undervalued in Australia. The ancient rock shelters destroyed in May were considered some of the country's most significant archaeological research areas. Greg McIntyre is a land rights expert and says tougher laws are needed.
Governments at both state and federal level need to be actively engaged in this and to take a different view about the juxtaposition between economic benefit and Australia's heritage. Heritage has been a very poor second cousin for decades now.
Aboriginal Australians consider the land to be the mother of creation, connecting them to their past, present and future. An Indigenous elder said his people felt immense grief and guilt at their failure to protect such a sanctified site at the Juukan Gorge that dated back tens of thousands of years. Rio Tinto has apologised and is scheduled to give evidence to the inquiry later this week. Three senior Rio executives were forced to quit last month after the scandal. New heritage laws are being drafted in the state of Western Australia to give Indigenous groups a greater say in the protection of their land under the proposals. In the past, some have agreed to sacrifice sacred sites to help their impoverished communities receive a share in mining revenue. The parliamentary inquiry is due to hand down its report in early December. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Workers at Ford Motor Company may have noticed a couple of dogs roaming the factory floor recently. The automaker has enlisted the help of some four-legged robots to map the factory floor. Able to climb stairs, open doors, and get into tight spots, these robo-dogs are ultimately saving their human colleagues time and money. Tina Trin reports.
It's the robotic version of man's best friend. The four-legged robot from Boston Dynamics is being put to work at Ford Motor Company in Michigan.
We were looking at a way to get into tight spots within our facilities, and Spot, who we nicknamed Fluffy, came up as a brainstorming idea. We could mount a 360 high-resolution camera onto it, as well as a laser scanner.
Fluffy works with an autonomous robot named Scatter to help create a 3D map of the factory floor.
They autonomously go through the plant and then stop, scan, move, stop, scan to waypoints like a GPS.
Fluffy goes where Scatter can't, helping create a more complete map of the space, which in turn helps engineers as they retool floor plans for production of new car models.
In some of our final assembly areas, the facility is changing monthly.
The robotic dog can be customized with a variety of sensors for different jobs.
Chemical manufacturing, you want a gas sensor to see if there's a leakage in the environment so that you can fix the leak faster. Other customers need a thermal camera so that they can look at the performance of some of their industrial equipment and say, oh, that is overheating and that could potentially cause a problem.
Ensuring worker safety in dangerous environments is one of the main benefits of using this robot. So is collecting more kinds of data.
We're creating all of these systems to interpret and collect and analyze big data. The problem is that we can only get a very narrow set of data into those systems.
Unlike a fixed sensor, this robot can collect data wherever it's programmed to go. Boston Dynamics is currently leasing the technology so companies can find ways to use it. For some, this robot dog could turn out to be a very good boy indeed. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
A new report points to allegations of violations of North Korean sanctions in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and observers say it is a sign of a systematic problem, and experts warn that unless the country improves its banking systems, it risks broader economic consequences. VOA's Salem Solomon has the story.
Business and banking dealings by North Koreans in the Democratic Republic of the Congo appear to violate numerous international sanctions, according to watchdog groups who say Pyongyang is taking advantage of the DRC's lax bank system. A report in August by Sentry, a Washington, D.C.-based organization that tracks money which finances conflict in Africa, found that in 2018, two North Korean businessmen traveled to the DRC on non-commercial visas, set up a construction firm, opened a bank account, and were awarded contracts for numerous projects, including building government-funded statues. Investigators say the report shows that North Korea is seeking out parts of the world where it can operate secretly and obtain foreign currency otherwise unavailable to the secretive and internationally isolated government.
All these different steps are important because that entire process is littered with a number of violations of UN, EU, and U.S. sanctions. And those sanctions specifically focus on preventing just the kind of activity we wrote about, which is North Koreans setting up businesses, which would give them an opportunity to generate revenue, and then allowing them to set up bank accounts that would enable them to transact in foreign currencies, which are critical to the government in Pyongyang.
That was John Deloso, senior investigator for Sentry. Jean-Louis Kayembe Wakayembe, who is the director general at the DRC Central Bank and head of the Monetary Policy Committee, declined to comment when contacted by VOA. North Korean officials have not commented on the Sentry allegations or business dealings in the DRC. The Sentry report says that upon arrival in the DRC, the North Korean men established relationships with elected officials from the People's Party for Reconstruction and Democracy, the former ruling party headed by ex-president Joseph Kabila. Among the projects undertaken by the North Koreans was building a statue of Kabila's father, ex-president Laurent Kabila, in the southern city of Kamina. Another statue they built in the city depicts a leader from the Luba ethnic group. Deloso said the opacity of the contracts makes it impossible to know exactly how much the men were paid, but he said similar statues can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. He also said it is unproven whether DRC officials knew they were breaking the law by doing business with North Koreans, but the general leniency in the country reveals major problems.
This wasn't just a single foul-up, if you want to call it that. There was a series of foul-ups that enabled this activity to take place. So even if the money had been small, we know that the North Koreans desperately try to get foreign currency and liquid funds that they can move back to Pyongyang. But the bigger question is, what else might be going on here in the country? And what is the level of enforcement of sanctions overall in the DRC?
In a recent event held by a Washington, D.C. think tank, the Atlantic Council, Congolese banking system expert Florbert Anzulini, the co-founder and coordinator of the Filimbi for Citizens Movement, said the country is particularly vulnerable to this type of activity.
I'm clearly not surprised by the content of the report. It's clearly a systemic problem. It's not only this one. It's the consequence of a systemic problem that the country is facing, which includes bad governance and, of course, corruption.
He added that the DRC is one of the only countries in the world without a national identification system. Therefore, its banks are accustomed to taking alternative forms of ID, making it easy for foreigners to open accounts without scrutiny. Deloso says since a large percentage of business in the DRC is conducted in foreign currency, the country relies on relationships with international banks to keep its economy moving.
If the DRC were deprived of US dollars, we're not just talking about large mining companies that all of a sudden are facing a crisis. We're talking about, you know, everyday people who are directly affected or indirectly affected. And that would be catastrophic, particularly in a country that's facing a lot of economic hardship right now connected to the COVID-19 pandemic and just general economic mismanagement.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. The vice presidential debate between Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris highlighted differences between their approaches on foreign policy and America's role in the world. The two candidates debated whether President Donald Trump or Democratic nominee Joe Biden would do a better job addressing challenges by U.S. rival China and its longtime adversary Iran. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Sawara reports.
The coronavirus has dominated American politics in recent months, but in this week's vice presidential debate, Vice President Mike Pence and his Democratic opponent Senator Kamala Harris argued their view of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and China, issues that have had less focus in the campaign so far. Pence highlighted the recent Abraham Accords that normalize Israel's relations with United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. He said the administration subdued Iran by assassinating its chief military strategist Qasem Soleimani and defeated ISIS.
President Trump unleashed the American military, and our armed forces destroyed the ISIS caliphate and took down their leader al-Baghdadi without one American casualty.
Kamala Harris said America is less safe because of Trump's unilateral approach to foreign policy. Citing the administration's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, achieved in 2015 with ally support.
What we have seen with Donald Trump is that he has betrayed our friends and embraced dictators around the world.
The Iran nuclear deal is a key difference between Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden, with Biden promising to return to it immediately if elected.
That would put Israel and some of the other U.S. allies in the region, the Persian Gulf region, countries like Saudi Arabia, they would then be on the defensive, and that would be a challenge. But I'm not at this point convinced that that would create a rupture in U.S. Israel relations, or for that matter, U.S.-Saudi relations.
Pence slammed Biden for being a cheerleader for communist China. He said the administration wants to improve relations with Beijing, but that Trump will also hold China accountable for the pandemic.
China and the World Health Organization do not play straight with the American people.
Harris accused Trump of hurting American jobs and economy because of his trade war with China. She cited recent global opinion polls by Pew Research that indicated U.S. allies now respect China's Xi Jinping more than they do Donald Trump.
This is where we are today because of a failure of leadership by this administration.
The Pence-Harris debate outlined a difference in foreign policy between Trump's America First doctrine and Biden's multilateral approach. If elected, Biden has promised he would return the U.S. to leadership roles in international organizations like the World Trade Organization and Trans-Pacific Partnership to contain adversaries, including China.
That, I think, would produce less uncertainty in the U.S.-China relationship. I think the nature of the relationship, fundamentally contentious and adversarial, would be the same in a second Trump term or in a Biden term.
While foreign policy is usually not at the forefront of voters' minds, one important issue this year is standing up for Israel, which matters to a key group of Trump supporters, evangelical Christians who made up about a third of Trump's backers in 2016. Both Trump and Biden have pledged continued support for Israel. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. Like most of the world, Afghanistan has seen its share of business losses due to the pandemic, with its agriculture sector being hit particularly hard. VOA's Asif Husani has more from Ghazni, Afghanistan, in this report narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Agriculture is the Afghanistan's biggest industry. It provides jobs for thousands of farmers and their families in the country, but COVID has changed all that.
This year, due to border problems, fertilizer has been available to us later and it's even more expensive. The second problem is because of transit issues, our exports have decreased.
Last year, the situation was better and our income was higher. But this year, due to the spread of the coronavirus, our wages are lower and we have problems.
Farmers here in Afghanistan's eastern province of Ghazni say the summer border closings hurt their exports.
Every year, about 5 to 6 cucumber trailers were exported daily from Ghazni province. But this year, due to the spread of the coronavirus, our exports have decreased and the price of cucumbers has also decreased.
Produce sellers in the local markets are also witnessing the pandemic's effects.
Coronavirus restrictions have had a negative effect on us. Produce has become cheaper and is not being exported.
Ghazni's Department of Agriculture says under the Farmers Support Program, measures are being taken to preserve unsold produce in refrigerated storage units so that local farmers and produce sellers are not left with losses.
Several raisin houses, potato, onion, and apple cold storages, as well as a number of dryers, have been allocated to Ghazni province from government.
But there is some hope. Local farmers here say that as COVID restrictions have begun to ease, demand and prices are slowly bouncing back. For Asif Husseini in Ghazni, Afghanistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Some social media watchers say Facebook's deletion of accounts targeting the Philippines from bases in China shows that the U.S. internet giant wants a better reputation in Southeast Asia after letting things slide in the past. Last month, Facebook said it had removed 155 of its own accounts and 6 Instagram accounts for violating an internal policy against foreign or government interference. James Gomez, regional director at the Bangkok-based think tank Asia Center, says Facebook's move will endear it to Filipinos.
It's more from a kind of a PR point of view. I do this at this particular time. Somehow it's seen as positive, and I can say, look, I had done this.
Facebook had been allowing relatively unfettered access by politicians, hate speech spreaders, and purveyors of fake news in the region. Ramon Casapol is the executive director of the Metro Manila-based advocacy group Institute for Political and Electoral Reform.
We would welcome that there is a self-governance on the part of Facebook. There was a lot of that in the past, up to now.
Eduardo Ararel, a Filipino and associate professor at the National University of Singapore's Public Policy School, says Filipinos are starting to eye the 2022 presidential election, motivating Facebook to clean up.
They have to be active in showing that Facebook is no longer used
can no longer be used as a platform for inauthentic behavior.
Facebook has also removed accounts in Singapore and Myanmar as both countries approach political milestones. We thank Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. A new exhibit at the recently reopened National Museum of American History shows the challenges young women face growing up in the United States. Girlhood, It's Complicated, showcases the lives of American girls who advocated for social change and shaped the country's history. Karina Bafrijan has the story.
The new exhibit opening at the National Museum of American History, called Girlhood, It's Complicated, highlights the sometimes difficult journey of women growing up in the United States.
We also want people to understand that girlhood's complicated, right? That girls take big risks to use their voices, to walk on the front lines of change, and to be political advocates.
The exhibition is divided into five sections: health, education, work, politics, and fashion. Each of them walks the visitors through the history of girls growing up and maturing during different times in American history, from the American Revolution to our days.
Girls are taught so much about where they fit in, what they should wear, how they should look, who is a girl, who is not, who is our ideal girl. And girls automatically become more conscious of themselves, and they try to express themselves through this barrage and tornado of advice coming at them, and that makes you political.
Girls with very different lives have become the center and focus of the exhibit, including Helen Keller, a well-known political activist and author who lived in the first half of the 20th century. She was rendered deaf and blind by a childhood illness, but still pursued a higher education and spent her life fighting racism and gender discrimination. The curators also spoke with many young girls across the nation to create the exhibit. The October 11 opening coincides with the United Nations International Day of the Girl Child, which aims to highlight the many challenges girls around the world face every day. The exhibit will stay open until 2022, giving girls and women more time to experience the exhibit firsthand. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
For several months, it looked like Malaysia had managed to contain the spread of COVID-19. But a recent surge in cases has many Malaysians worried. As Dave Grunebaum reports, the rising health concerns are taking an increasing toll on local businesses.
Hi, welcome. Hi, welcome to lunch.
Alex Chong hopes to pick up some customers for his restaurant. But this shopping mall is very light on foot traffic at a time of day when it's typically busy.
I'm totally blank. I don't know what to do.
Chong's company owns 9 restaurants, including this one called Lele. After several rough months at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, business began to bounce back in August and September. But this month, Chong's restaurants have seen a dramatic drop in customers once again.
So people are just staying at home, and they are more afraid.
The reason? Significant increases in the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Malaysia. The country had record high numbers of new cases several days last week. Hakimi Azri enjoyed lunch out with a few friends, but he says occasions like this are becoming rare for him because the rising count of cases has convinced him to spend more time at home.
So I only just go to work and then just go back direct, immediately go back to the house. I can see even for my colleague and my friends, I can see they are doing like that.
Chong says business at his restaurants is down more than 50% compared to just a few weeks ago. He says if this continues for a few more weeks, he might have to close down two of his restaurants and lay off about 20 employees.
We'll have to shut down those locations whereby our landlords don't give us rebates. Our landlords don't help us, with the rentals.
Lim Brothers Fruits has been serving this Kuala Lumpur neighborhood for 45 years. They're known for their fresh-made spicy fruit salad. But they say business has dropped almost 40% in just the past week. They say they're now barely breaking even and cannot handle any more strain on the bottom line.
Much more fear, concern about the businesses will be affect on the rental of this shop and the salary of our staff.
Welcome.
Just as some local businesses were thinking the worst might be behind them, this resurging health crisis is showing the economy is continuing to struggle. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Kuala Lumpur.
You can follow more on this and all of our other stories by following us on Twitter at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And of course, you can visit the voanews.com website. North Korea has unveiled what defense analysts say appears to be a new intercontinental ballistic missile. The ICBM was displayed during a carefully choreographed military parade that was held despite concerns about the coronavirus pandemic. VOA's Bill Gallo tells us more from Seoul.
If North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is worried about the coronavirus, it wasn't evident Saturday. The North Korean leader oversaw a massive military parade with no attendees seen social distancing or wearing masks. An emotional Kim apologized for recent economic troubles, but insisted not a single North Korean had fallen victim to COVID-19.
Above all, I feel very grateful for all our people being healthy and sound.
Afterwards, North Korea unveiled what some analysts described as a monster new intercontinental ballistic missile. It's perhaps the world's largest road mobile ICBM, says analyst Bruce Klingner.
It gives North Korea more capability, most likely for payload. They already have the Hwasong 15, which can range all of the continental United States. So having a larger missile would enable it perhaps to have multiple warheads or what's known as penetration aids, ways of deceiving anti-ballistic missile defenses.
The ICBM may be the new strategic weapon Kim promised at the beginning of the year, but Kim may be reluctant to test it before the upcoming U.S. presidential election.
What I would expect is to see that ICBM tested next year. What North Korea tends to do is something very provocative in the first year of a new U.S. or South Korean administration. So regardless of who the U.S. president is next year, I'd expect to see this new ICBM tested.
U.S. President Donald Trump has warned Kim against any major provocations near the November 3rd U.S. election. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
China is showing no sign of easing its military intimidation against Taiwan. After reportedly flying a military transport aircraft near the airspace of the island last week, which it views as a renegade province, reports say the plane flew over Taiwan's Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIZ, but it did not cross the so-called Taiwan Strait median line separating China from the self-ruling island. There has been no comment from Taiwan defense officials on the reported incursion. With China now denying the existence of the median line, some argue that for the sake of deterrence, Taiwan should consider following suit. Others believe such a reciprocal response will do Taiwan no good and fuel further tension. Oh Yi-sun is a senior fellow with Singapore Institute of International Affairs.
This is sort of a brinksmanship at play here. Ultimately, it depends on how resolved both sides are in terms of their claim of sovereignty, as well as their counterclaim for not having such sovereignty.
In the face of China's military provocation, recent polls showed that a record 86% of people in Taiwan identified themselves as Taiwanese instead of Chinese. President Donald Trump says he will not participate in a virtual debate, and that's leaving the status of the rest of the debates in limbo. VOA's Steve Reddish brings us up to date.
Could the vice presidential debate have been the final debate of 2020? Mitchell McKinney is director of the Political Communication Institute at the University of Missouri.
I think there will be another debate.
Halfway through the four scheduled debates, the quadrennial campaign ritual is on hold. After President Donald Trump's COVID diagnosis, the Commission on Presidential Debates announced the next presidential debate on Thursday, October 15th, planned as a town hall event with undecided voters asking their questions, would be held virtually for pandemic safety reasons. Again, Mitchell McKinney.
If we could go forward with a virtual town hall, I think it would be so symbolic, emblematic of what the nation is doing.
President Trump told Fox Business News he was not going to waste his time on a virtual debate, calling it ridiculous. Karin Vasby Anderson is a professor of communication studies at Colorado State University.
If it's on Zoom and his mic is cut, then he can raise his voice and keep speaking as much as possible, but it is technologically possible to silence him. And in any face-to-face context, you could cut his mic. But if he's speaking up, it's going to be picked up by Biden's mic.
The announcement of a virtual debate and President Trump's dismissal of it came less than 12 hours after Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris met in the year's only vice presidential debate. Again, Karin Vasby Anderson.
So did Pence kind of bolster Trump's appeal and what Trump has been saying about these various issues? And did Harris project a consistent message, a message that was consistent with Biden? Yes, they both absolutely did that.
Here again, Mitchell McKinney from the University of Missouri.
You know, there were two starkly different narratives developed by these two candidates. One is, boy, these 4 years have been, you know, wonderful under the leadership of Donald Trump. And if not for Donald Trump, it would just be much worse. And all of the great things, even on the coronavirus and then, of course, you know, her prosecuting the record of at one point, what did she say on the coronavirus? This is the worst debacle in the history of the presidency and doesn't deserve four more years. So we had those two contrasting images of narratives.
Analysts saw a recurring theme from the debate performances of Trump and Pence, ignoring the moderator and breaking rules. Here again, Karin Vasby Anderson from Colorado State University.
As we got into the debate, he made it clear that he thought that it was his role to decide how long he spoke, when he spoke, what he spoke about. So he wrested authority that had been rooted in the moderator. He took the initiative to try to get Senator Harris to answer his questions, questions that had not been posed by the moderator. So he made it very clear that he thought that it was his role to be the authoritative presence in that debate.
I do think that maybe Mike Pence took advantage in a way of, okay, you know, I'm winning this battle. I'm ignoring the rules, I'm breaking the rules.
I did not create the rules for tonight.
She's kind of pleaded with me. I'm just going to continue doing it. And then she sort of, after a while, just sort of gave it up.
The scheduled town hall debate on October 15th will not take place. Former Vice President Joe Biden has already scheduled a televised event that night, taking questions from voters. President Trump has indicated he wants to hold a live event that evening as well. The final presidential debate is scheduled for October 22nd in Nashville, Tennessee. The Trump campaign is pressing for another debate on October 29th. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
We continue with VOA Asia Weekend. While U.S. President Donald Trump has slipped in recent national polls, he retains core backing in much of America's farm country, where new trade pacts and massive government assistance for the agriculture sector are popular. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports, along with the coronavirus pandemic, aid and trade are on the minds of many farmers as they prepare to vote in the November 3rd contest between Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden.
Earlier this year, Ron Moore was preparing for another year of trade uncertainty with China, one of the largest purchasers of the soybeans he grows on his rural Illinois farm. But what he didn't see coming was a global coronavirus pandemic that rattled the food supply chain, pushing down wholesale prices for livestock and the foodstuffs they consume.
That decimated the demand for the grains that provide the feed for the livestock.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture reports amid the trade war, soybean prices fell 35% between 2014 and 2019, even before the pandemic reduced Chinese purchases further.
It was a double whammy, so to speak.
Prices for corn, one of the key crops on Wendell Schaumann's farm, fell 44% between 2014 and 2019. He hasn't seen a significant rebound.
It's been a pretty ugly year price-wise. Most of what I sold was way below what I'd hoped for.
Which is why both Moore and Schaumann say the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Market Facilitation Program payments to farmers since 2018 kept them afloat as the Trump administration negotiated new trade deals.
But it was certainly a big help. I'm sure there are people that wouldn't have had anything to eat if it didn't happen.
It gives us a lifeline. We're still trading water. We need more profitability, better markets for us to get out of the water and get up on dry land.
The USDA unveiled a $19 billion aid package earlier this year as the pandemic constricted the nation's food supply. Another round of $14 billion in agricultural assistance followed in September. Illinois Farm Bureau's National Legislative Director Adam Nielsen says government spending totaling nearly $100 billion since 2016 had a positive impact.
We've been able to stem the tide of farm bankruptcies. Farmers, while they haven't been spending extravagantly, have been able to pay for feed, seed, and fertilizer to get another crop in the ground.
While Wendell Schaumann says government aid on that scale can't continue forever,
there's not enough money for the government to just keep giving everybody a living. That just doesn't work.
He nevertheless credits President Trump for progress on trade issues and hopes America forges a permanent agreement with China.
I like what he's done. I don't like the way he talks sometimes. I get frustrated with that. You could have some better manners.
Hey, man.
Which is why Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's message of bipartisan cooperation also resonates with Schaumann.
You've got to have compromise. You've got to have people working together.
What Schaumann doesn't like are what he perceives as demands to completely overhaul the U.S. economy to combat climate change.
I haven't heard anybody talking about a battery-driven tractor yet. What am I going to plant with? The talk just seems nonsensical to me.
A late September poll of rural Americans showed President Trump with a 17-point lead over Biden. In the same poll, 59% of farmers said they would be struggling financially without the USDA's Market Facilitation Program and the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program.
Regardless of some of the outcomes or how people want to look at it, I think President Trump has, you know, focused attention on rural America, where maybe that hasn't been the case in quite a few years.
Trump's popularity in rural areas endures at a time when the president's national poll numbers have dipped. While many Illinois farmers voice support for Trump, the most recent statewide poll, including America's third largest city, Chicago, gives Biden a commanding 25-point lead, 61% to 36%. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Roseville, Illinois.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, this election season, young American voters are raising their voices and demanding action to fight climate change. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias looks at how young people, Democrats and Republicans, are urging communication and compromise to tackle what most climate scientists call a global existential threat.
We're taking an electric car around the entire United States to showcase market-based, innovative ways to solve climate change.
22-year-old Benji Backer, a Republican, says conservative values can solve climate change.
There needs to be kind of this transformation of environmentalism from being the token Democrat issue to being an issue that both sides have a stake at the table on. Republicans and conservatives tend to live in rural areas. They tend to live on farms and on ranches and in the mountains. They care about the environment.
Backer's group is proposing a climate contract that, among other things, calls for using technology to remove carbon emissions from fossil fuels while a phased transition to a cleaner economy takes place. For their part, many Democrats support the Green New Deal, which proposes faster, more extensive actions. Yet, many are open to bipartisan discussions.
We can debate on policy and make compromises at the basis of what we believe in is that every person deserves a chance to live in like a world that isn't burning and flooding.
But ahead of November's presidential election, the COVID-19 pandemic and the economy are what Americans are most concerned about. When it comes to climate change, there is a huge gap between backers of President Donald Trump and his Democratic opponent, Joe Biden.
Just 17% of Trump supporters say that climate change is a very important issue to them this fall, but very different views among Joe Biden supporters. Almost 7 in 10, or 68%, say that climate change is a very important issue to their votes.
Yet, that partisan divide is notably smaller among younger people, the Pew Research Center's polling found.
Young Republicans really think the country should prioritize alternative energy development, things like wind and solar power. And that's a pretty big difference, because older Republicans are still a bit more supportive of oil, coal, natural gas.
How you doing, man?
Climate change was only briefly discussed at the first presidential debate, but voters under 35 want to hear more.
It's an issue that deserves far more time to be discussed and far more time for our candidates to be asked those questions, because this is about our future.
Young voters want to be more responsible about things going forward, whether that's us on our campuses and, you know, just dealing with like daily lifestyle changes, but also, you know, making sure that we are talking to our legislators.
Independent voters, who make up 40% of the electorate, according to the group Independent Voting, support major structural changes, irrespective of their ages. While young Americans may disagree on the approach to climate change, they want solutions.
Most young people are very passionate and agree about the importance and impact of addressing climate change. Why is it taken for granted that the U.S. government cannot be updated and reinvented so that it addresses the problems that are facing today?
The challenge for young voters now, turning that passion into action.
Typically fewer than half of younger voters end up actually voting. And every 4 years, there's a lot of conversation, will young people vote at higher rates than they have in the past? And the most direct answer is we don't know.
Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
For almost 2 years, a group of dedicated young women in a conservative neighborhood of Karachi have been working to beat the odds and change the culture around them. The women are doing it by cycling. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Pakistan's largest city, Karachi.
Riding a bicycle sounds like a very ordinary activity in many parts of the world. Not here, and not for these girls. This is Liari, a conservative neighborhood in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi. Women here are mostly absent from public life. So when a Germany-sponsored NGO called Liari Girls Cafe helped a group of young girls learn how to ride a bicycle, locals were shocked. Initially, the resistance was strong. People would pass foul comments. Some local madrasas even sent young students to throw stones at them.
Sometimes the criticism was so harsh that we felt disturbed and mentally tortured, but we did not give up and continue our journey.
Every Sunday, these girls pick up their bikes and take them to an empty parking lot to practice. For them, it is more than a simple sport. It is a form of activism.
I belong to an area where girls are often suppressed. I did not want my daughters to go through what I went through as a child. I started cycling myself so I can bring my daughters with me.
Not a single one of these young women owns a bike. The 30 bikes they share among themselves have been mostly donated by local authorities or the German consulate in Karachi. Ultimately, these girls are hoping to change attitudes. They want cycling to become normal for females. They want to be able to do it in their daily lives, to go to school or to work. Their hopes for the future are high, but for now, this stretch of road, empty on a Sunday morning, is the only space they have to express their passion. Aisha Tanzeen, VOA News, Karachi.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.